I'm David Martin Davies, and this is The Source. The national opioid epidemic is evident in the streets of Bexar County. To confront this public health emergency, Bexar County, the City of San Antonio, and the University Health System have created the Joint Opioid Task Force. They're working to decrease the number of opioid deaths in Bexar County and develop strategies to address the opioid crisis in a comprehensive manner. If you are having any contact with the streets of San Antonio, you can see this problem. So tell us what you see. What do you think needs to be done? How has the opioid crisis impacted you or your family? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 210-614-8980. You could email us at thesource@tpr.org, and you can tweet at us at @tprsource. Our guest this hour, we're joined by Dr. Jennifer Potter. She's the associate professor and associate dean of research at the School of Medicine at the UT Health San Antonio. Josh Green is with us, the Youth Recovery Community Center coordinator and peer recovery leader at Rise Recovery. Abigail Moore is here, the CEO of the San Antonio Council on Drug and Alcohol Abuse. It's great to have you here this afternoon. It's great to have you all with us. And again, the number is 210-614-8980. So, Abigail Moore with the San Antonio Council on Drug and Alcohol Abuse, can you give us an update on where are we in Bexar County with the opioid crisis?
Yes, we're very active as a task force. The opioid task force, the joint task force here in Bexar County, is really addressing prevention, treatment, and recovery of opioid disorders and bringing our community together in working on this opioid epidemic here in our community.
How bad is it?
It's pretty bad. We were getting the data earlier today by EMS, and we're having anywhere from 3 to 5 calls per day of our EMS using Narcan and bringing people back after an overdose. And that's 3 to 5 a day. We are also having anywhere from 3 to 5 babies born per week with opioids in their system. So the numbers are big. And so we are really coming together as a group and providing prevention, intervention, and recovery for our community.
Dr. Jennifer Potter, do we have a trend? Is it getting worse?
What we're seeing is that heroin continues to be a problem, as well as illicit fentanyl. That is not fentanyl available by prescription, but synthetic manufactured illicit fentanyl that's sold on the streets. I actually think right now we're stabilizing. What we're experiencing right now is the advent of the opioid crisis because of the overdoses that are occurring. That means that people have not gotten access to treatment. People have not identified that problem early enough to prevent that overdose. And we haven't prevented a problem that we really need to get a handle on in this city.
So I'm still trying to figure out, you know, how bad is it? I mean, it's bad. I mean, you know, but how bad is bad?
So from my perspective, yeah. every life lost to drug addiction is bad. We have an issue. You can look at other parts of the country and say it's higher or it's lower, but that's not going to change the life of a mom or somebody else who's lost a child to substance use in this country. And for them, it's very personal and it's a very significant problem.
I was taking a bus home the other day. Guy recognized me on the bus. Hey, you're an NPR. He says, can I say, yeah, hey. And he came back and we talked for a while. And he's dealing with his opioid addiction. And he tells me it's bad. Mm-hmm. It's cutting through his generation. People on the streets, this is not just one person out there. Yeah, if there's one person, we need to save one person. We're talking about lots and lots of people, a generation at the least.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at the national statistics, we are seeing one of the greatest causes of death in the United States right now is opioid overdose. I'll mention alcohol is up there as well, alcohol abuse. But nationally, we are losing, I think it's reasonable to say, a significant generation of young people and their lives are lost. There's great potential there, and it impacts our entire country.
And also impacts people who aren't really involved in this world because there are ripple effects. Family members and also the social system that we have trying to avoid this and invest in this now because it could get worse if we don't address this, Jennifer Potter?
It already has gotten worse. I mean, that's the reason we're in this crisis. I started in this field almost 20 years ago in 2005. We were looking at concerns about prescription opioid abuse in this country in 2005. That's 13 years ago. And it's continued to get worse and worse and worse. I went back and looked at some of the articles that we'd written in 05 and even in 2011. And you know, we've been saying this for a long time, and somehow collectively asleep at the wheel, and now we're dealing with death for something that is imminently treatable. Addiction is a treatable disorder, and we didn't do our job.
I'm going to go to the phone lines, 210-614-8980. Chris is on the line. Chris, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, David. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, so I believe from my own experience that it's just crucial to start teaching kids about the danger of drugs while they're in school. So many kids, they say that marijuana is not a gateway drug, but from my own experience in middle school and high school, people start trying marijuana, and that progresses to cocaine, and then that progresses to methamphetamine, and then, you know, I think a lot of people end up in heroin. And I think that if we could get that education out of the danger of trying these drugs at a young age, it'd really go a long way.
Okay, Chris, thank you for that call. Let me go to Josh Green. He's a youth recovery community center coordinator, peer recovery leader for Rise Recovery. Is your experience that marijuana is the gateway drug and that prevention, getting rid and trying to educate the youth is the key here?
I wouldn't say that there's any one specific drug that is more of a gateway drug than any other. I think that any drug that somebody, especially young people, have widespread access to, like marijuana, is going to end up being a gateway drug. I think a common misconception that often happens is we think that it's the drug that makes the addict or a drug that makes somebody addicted. When that's not really the case, that's just a vehicle for their addiction, so to speak. More things like environment, past trauma, family situation, social sphere, things like that are what more often than not push somebody into addiction or bring it to the surface. And we've seen for a long time, we've had the DARE campaign in schools, variations of that for a very long time. There's no lack of prevention being taught in schools, at least in my experience. Yet the numbers still show that about, I think it's 60 or maybe slightly over kids are going to at least experiment with marijuana or alcohol before they graduate from high school in some areas. And just looking at it, you know, statistically, how many of those kids, you know, that innocently tried marijuana or alcohol like their peers are going to end up addicts?
Right. So we need to educate people about the dangers of heroin or other hard drugs and try to let them know beforehand that they don't need to experiment, or if they're experiment, what happens if that experiment fails, and what's at risk?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that what was vitally important is teaching not only about addiction in schools and from a young age, but also a realistic look at addiction, that it is a statistical thing that is bound to happen to you or somebody that you know, to one of your friends, and that to be aware of recovery and support services and how you can help yourself or somebody once they're in that position, because the chances are that you are going to know somebody, if it's not yourself, that's affected or directly affected by substance use disorder.
We're talking about opioids in our community, the crisis that we have right now. We know that it's taking lives. We know that it's demanding resources. What can we do in Bexar County to take this problem on, have prevention and treatment available for those who need it? We invite you to call in with your comments, your observations, 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this quick break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about opioid crisis in Bexar County. We now have Dr. David Tuscher with us. He is with the United States Health and Human Services Agency, Region 6. And Dr. David Tuscher, welcome to The Source.
Thank you, David. And thank you for spotlighting a particularly bad scourge on our society. You were asking how bad is it? It's so bad that we're losing more people to opioid overdoses in a given year, the last 3 years that we have statistics, than we were in motor vehicle accidents. It's not just hundreds, it's thousands of people. It's really affecting our young people in a very, very bad way. But we're doing something about that. And I want to give compliments to your folks that are there. Many of them, I had the opportunity to take my training in San Antonio as an orthopedic surgeon and an MD, and so many people that are on your show right now, so my compliments to them. We're not going to win this alone. The important thing for your listeners is what can you do? And so next Saturday is the National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day. It'll be our 14th annual Take-Back Day. It's from 10 to 2 and Saturday, locations around your city. There's opportunities that we can help you publicize that. But it's a no questions asked. You just bring the medications that you don't need in your prescription, put them in a bag, and just dump them off there, and we will take care of them in collaboration with the United States Drug Enforcement Administration, who has to administrate the disposal of those. Don't flush them down your toilet. Take them back, and this is the way to get them out of your house. If you were given a prescription and you don't need it, don't leave it in your pill bottle where other people could try it and then get addicted. We don't know who is a potential addict. There's a five-point plan. The president has declared it a national health emergency. Our secretary has it as one of his top four priorities. So I can tell you that the full faith of the federal government is behind it, and the people that are in your audience and with you today are certainly part of the coalition. And we're not going to solve this unless we all work together.
What about the law enforcement part of this problem? The administration seems to be taking a harder line when it comes to trying to do enforcement by putting people in jail for rather than treatment.
Well, I would beg to differ with you slightly on that. I think they are taking a harder line on illegal imports of the fentanyl compounds that are coming out of China and out of Mexico. But we know, and the five-point plan understands, that a jail cell is not a place to have recovery. We have to treat this as a health disorder. No one chooses to be an addict, but once you become addicted or a substance use disorder, then you need real help and real counseling. And there are medication-assisted treatments that are available within the community as well. So I don't think that we can discount our law enforcement. They deal with it all the time. Another area where we're really working on is reversal drugs. So the reversal drug is called Narcan or Naloxone, and a lot of our first responders are now carrying that. In fact, the fentanyl problem has gotten so bad in some areas of the country that the first responders who are trying to help somebody who's overdosed will actually contact enough of the substance that they actually are suffering and have to inject themselves through the nose with this inhaler to be able to reverse that. It's a big problem, but we all have to work together. We can't just simply say it's a law enforcement problem and lock people up in jail.
When we do, law enforcement is going to be the agency that's going to have the most contacts, or EMS, emergency personnel, with folks who are in this world locked in addiction. And when they do end up in a county jail cell, do we have national standards in how to provide a treatment for folks who are addicted and trying to provide counseling, relief, and treatment?
We are developing those at the professional society levels. We're certainly getting much better at it, but again, we need more research. We need to know who has the potential because of their DNA and their neuroreceptors of becoming potentially addicted to that. And then how can we actually maybe even vaccinate them or give them gene therapy so that they would never become addicted? And then the other part, as I said, is how do you treat the reversal. So somebody's becoming an addict and they've overdosed. How do we save their life? And our first responders have to have that Narcan available immediately, get them through EMS into the hospital system, but then also into the addiction treatment specialties. You have many, many fabulous people working there in San Antonio on this. There's support groups. There's a lot of counselors who had formerly had addiction issues. They're probably the best people to talk to people about how do you have a life after addiction.
All right. Dr. David Tischer, thank you so much. He's with the Health and Human Services Region 6 Director. Appreciate you calling in and giving us an update on the view on dealing with the opioid crisis from your point of view. So back to the panel that we have here in the studio, I want to go to Dr. Jennifer Potter. Can you talk from your research? You study the addiction and the effects of all this. What does it take to become addicted to a product like this?
You mean to a prescription opioid?
Or, you know, like you get exposed to it and it's like you don't take one pill and get addicted. I mean, do some do and some don't? Or it's really confusing.
So it is confusing and it's complicated. And as was just mentioned, we do absolutely need more research on the risk factors once somebody has been exposed. The reality is we have some information now. We know that individuals who are exposed to an opioid who have a history in their family or in themselves of psychiatric issues may be more vulnerable. We know if you have a family or personal history of any substance use disorder, you may be more at risk for developing a problem after receiving a prescription for an opioid. Those are two big predictors. It's also true, the doctor was referring to neurobiological factors that might be associated, and there is evidence that people respond to opioids differently. And if you have a different brain makeup, just to keep it simple, you may be more vulnerable, and we don't know enough about that. But I have to keep it really simple in this time. The vast majority of people exposed to a prescription opioid will not go on to develop a substance use disorder. The problem is, for those who are exposed, we don't have a good test. We don't know who's going to become vulnerable and who's not, which is why we need to take universal precautions, just like we would with any other side effect when people are exposed. And that's critical. But I have to keep focusing on the fact that in this country today, we have safe and effective treatments for substance use disorders, including opioid use disorder, that people do not have access to. And that's the big problem.
All right, let's go back to the phone lines. And Diana is on the line. Diana, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask your panel, what about the collateral damage from this war on opiates? And by collateral damage, I mean the people that suffer with chronic constant pain that have had their opioid prescriptions reduced due to the CDC guidelines that turned into restrictions. And without managed pain, you cannot lead a productive life. Opioid addicted people are being brought back to life, given all kinds of services to overcome addiction. And I think in the conversation, people in constant chronic pain are the ones paying the price.
All right, Diana, thank you for the call. Let me get Dr. Jennifer Potter to respond to that.
I'm really happy that caller made this point, and I hope that she heard me say that most of the people who are exposed to an opioid as a medication treatment will not go on to misuse. It is incredibly important that we do not disenfranchise an entire group of patients. The number one reason why people go to the doctor is for pain. We do not have good non-opioid-based pain management programs and treatments in this country, and that's also where we need to spend research. There is a very high concern in the pain community about the method and approach by which people are losing access to opioids without appropriate alternatives. There are concerns that have not yet been completely borne out, but we do have anecdotal evidence that there are concerns about increased risk of suicide in the face of unbearable chronic pain. We are in a very difficult situation in this country because we need to balance two groups of patients that both need attention. We have not done a good job of addressing pain in this country. We have a national pain strategy that has not been fully funded. So as much as we need to focus on addiction, I am an addiction specialist. It is what my heart does. We need to not lose sight of what that caller was saying about how we manage pain in this country.
So understanding pain is a medical mystery. Trying to figure that out. And we've also learned that people who have become opioid dependent have increased levels of pain on the other side of that. And so that kind of makes us aware that we've got to come up with other pain strategies.
Yes, absolutely. And I should mention that UT Health San Antonio has one of the national groups that is working on coming up with non-opioid pain approaches. And these are medication-based approaches with what we call reduced abuse liability. So they either are opioids that don't have an abuse potential or is lower, or they're completely different classes of medication. And that research is ongoing. It's going on in our dental school and our school of medicine. That's the type of research that we need to be focusing on, is how we can find appropriate pain medications that don't have the risk, as well as behavioral treatments and all the other ways that you can address pain.
Here's another caller, Vicki. Hi, Vicki. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Hold on 1 second here. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I'm an opioid addict for 25 years. I've been on methadone for the last 3 years. A lot of people don't consider that being clean, but I no longer use heroin. And I just want to say, I don't think education is all that it's cracked up to be, because the people that are teaching it haven't been there. I mean, they would have to be educated by someone who's been there and done that. You know, that's just one of those things. But I've worked really hard in my life to get myself cleaned up. And, you know, it's just a really hard thing. I am afraid of what's out there these days.
What are you afraid of?
Fentanyl, the other kind of crap. I mean, I just don't know what they're putting in there.
Right.
You know, I mean, you're taking a risk when you're scoring something illegal. Now, as far as OxyContin and all of that, I do know it's overly prescribed. I know a lot of people that have those prescriptions sell them. And I don't know. As far as this whole debate goes, I just want people to remember that, you know, we all didn't wake up one day to say, I want to be a junkie.
All right.
But there is a point where I think you do make a conscious choice. You know, there's a time where you get yourself cleaned up, and you know if you make that phone call, you know how it's going to play out.
Vicki, thank you so much for the call. And it sounds like you're, you know, taking the methadone. I know that's a road to recovery or stabilization. Josh Green, Youth Recovery Community Center Coordinator, Peer Recovery Leader at Rise Recovery. But you have been there. You were there now, right, in a way?
Yeah. I'm a young person in long-term recovery. I've been in recovery for almost going on 5 years now. And I'm, you know, I think that when it comes to talk about addiction, especially opioid use disorder and addiction, in our country, when we're talking about recovery support services, we're working against a massive stigma. I'm not what, you know, I know we're on the radio, I'm not what you would think of.
You don't look like anybody who's strung out on a junkie. You look, you know, very healthy and, you know, very athletic.
Yeah, and I could tell you that I actually do. I actually do look like thousands of people that are struggling with addiction. It's not a disease that discriminates based on any.
And it's hitting every part of the city, all segments of life, every demographic, some worse than others, but it's everywhere. We're going to talk about peer recovery when we come back and what it means to have been there. And what San Antonio needs to be doing in order to head off the opioid addiction crisis before it gets any worse. The number is 210-614-8980. A two-minute break, and we'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the opioid crisis and our community. There is a task force here in Bexar County that's trying to take this on, the Opioid Crisis Task Force. It's a combination of Bexar County, the City of San Antonio, and also the UT Health Science Center. They don't call it UT Health Science Center anymore, but that's what it is. And working together, bringing all our big brains together to look at the evidence, look at the treatment, look at the research, trying to figure out how San Antonio, Bexar County can deal with the opioid crisis. We invite you into the conversation, 210-614-8980. Jared is on the line. Jared, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that there's a lot more to just the opioid crisis. There's a lot more. The thing of it is very, very, very. I mean, there's
there's the fact that there's prescribing Suboxone to people that are coming off of opiates. You know, Suboxone is basically heroin, just FDA-approved heroin that they can give out to people. And this, I'm a recovering addict myself from IV meds. So, I mean, you know, what they're giving people to, like, get off of this stuff, it's kind of contradicting, like, the whole having a crisis thing, because we're helping the problem.
All right, Jared, thank you so much for bringing up Suboxone. And that is something that, when used in treatment, it seems to be working really well, but somehow it's being used more widely. And so I'm going to go to the expert on this, Dr. Jennifer Potter. Where are we with Suboxone? Why, this is, it seemed to me, just suddenly I hadn't heard about it, and now I'm hearing about it everywhere.
Sure. So Suboxone has been approved. The active ingredient is a medicine called buprenorphine. It's a partial opioid agonist. But what that means is really that it's a medication that's used to treat opioid use disorder. There is some confusion, I would argue, and this is including in the federal government occasionally, where individuals talk about it as just replacing one medication with another. I understand the caller's perspective, and it is confusing. Having said that, what we know about that medicine is it is a little bit different, first of all, than the drugs that you can buy on the street, like heroin. And that medicine is given under a doctor's supervision. It is very carefully regulated, and it's monitored. The reason that the use of Suboxone to treat has increased has been actually quite intentional. We did a number of studies, I was involved in some of them, that were designed to get an FDA indication for buprenorphine. The advantage of buprenorphine over methadone is that in this country, you can prescribe buprenorphine as long as you have what's called an X waiver. So what that means is a doctor who's trained in how to use this medication can give that medication in an outpatient basis. It's sometimes used for detox, but it's more often used for maintenance. And what that means is they're basically getting a medicine to treat an opioid use disorder. It may be that it's not for everyone, but what we know is when we do the research, and I've done these studies, I was part of the largest national study looking at treatment for prescription opioid use disorder, and over 96% of people in that study were not able to maintain abstinence in the absence of buprenorphine.
But the it seems like this is being touted as a solution, like a silver bullet. And I hear a lot of people talking about this as a way, and I'm an opioid addict and I need support, and they gave me this prescription and now I'm getting the Suboxone and it's not working for me. So it's got a different things, yeah, for different folks.
So here's the subtlety to this, is there is no silver bullet for usually any health condition. When somebody is prescribed buprenorphine, if I take a group of 500 people who are prescribed buprenorphine as a treatment, generally speaking, about half of those individuals are going to experience substantial response to that medication such that they are what we would call in recovery. First, they need to continue to take the medication. Over 60% of individuals who take buprenorphine often have some difficulty maintaining the regimen, and so that doesn't help. We also have very few medications that work for everyone, and that's across all diseases. You know, even if something as simple as Tylenol works for some people and ibuprofen works for others for pain relief over the counter. So we have to understand that you can't take one medicine and have it solve all of the issues. It's
sure.
One treatment option. But I will tell you, it is one of the best treatment options out there if you're going to save a life and save someone's life through treatment.
And so the advantage of prescribing this is it gets people off the street-level drugs. We heard from the caller earlier talking about that the drugs on the street are laced with fentanyl and carfentanil, which are can be fatal because we don't know the levels in which they're putting in these in a heroin dose on the streets. Get them out of that, stabilize them, and then taper them off. Is that the plan until they can be?
So in medicine today, we talk about a patient-centered approach or a patient-partnered approach. For some individuals, they may decide that they want to taper off that medicine and not have that as part of their treatment. And high-quality healthcare would be one where they work on that with the patient and see how they respond. If they don't seem to respond, then they might look at a longer period of time on the medicine. For other people, and this is true for methadone as well, there are individuals who live rich, positive, productive lives, and they'll be on methadone for years, if not decades.
Okay, let's go to another caller. This is Arthur. Arthur, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. How you doing? I was calling because I had suffered from addiction in the past, and, you know, there's programs out there. There are good programs out there, but there are also some bad programs out there. And I'm going to name the place, but, you know, you go to a church, and they offer this one particular church offers programs for you, and they try to get you out, but then they send you out to ask for money for the church. And not that the church doesn't need money, but, you know, when you're struggling with something like this, how are you trying to help someone else when you can't even help yourself? You know, it took me to work on myself, to get up every day, to tell myself I'm not a loser, I'm not a junkie, I'm better than that, to fix what was going on.
And Arthur, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. You've really been very helpful with that call. Let me go over to Abigail Moore with the San Antonio Council on Drug and Alcohol Abuse for your reaction.
Yes, Arthur's correct. There are some programs out there that are not evidence-based, and they don't use best practices in helping people needing substance use disorder treatment. And so they give recovery a bad name. But there are good programs out there, recovery coaching, state-funded programs, insurance programs, faith-based programs. There are some faith-based programs that are very effective and hold each other accountable and don't take advantage of people sending them out trying to collect money in the streets. I hear what Arthur's saying. But yes, there are some best practice programs in our city. So they could call our office, they could talk to a recovery coach, and they can navigate what's best for their recovery. And individuals find a different pathway, what works best for them.
Now, we hear talk about this high fatality rate that we're getting from the opioid crisis. And one story I hear is that there are folks who go into some of these areas for some treatment and are not 100% Jake outfits. And then they falter. And then when they go back to using, they go back to using at their previous level. And they've lost some of their tolerance, or they're in a state, and that's when they overdose.
They're at higher risk for overdose. As Dr. Potter was also saying, when individuals are encouraged by their family or peer or people that don't have the full education on what this medically assisted treatment is, and they tell them, you need to taper down and you need to get off of those other medications because you're just replacing one thing with another.
So you those need folks, medically supervised yes, treatment.
Yes, because individuals that taper down themselves or don't have access to this medication, yes, they are at higher risk for an overdose.
So let me go over to Josh Green and talk about what your observations are. What is a treatment that you think has a high level of, I mean, we can't say it's going to work because we never know. People are different and we can't promise anything, but what are you seeing is showing some traction of success?
To reiterate what was already said, there definitely is a discrepancy that there's not access. People do not have access to enough effective and best practiced evidence-based treatment in our country. But even those that do, for an addict that's been using for, let's say, 10 years and then they have a 30-day stay in a treatment center, is that enough for them to be able to facilitate a new way of living and overcome addiction? Generally, it's not. Especially with young people, it's absolutely not. But something recently there's been a huge there's been an adoption of what's called peer support services. And that could be defined as non-professional, non-clinical help people with a shared experience helping each other to stay sober. And what that helps to do is foster the things that we know are important for long-term recovery, like a new friend group, a therapeutic community, support, person-driven recovery, like was already mentioned. So those are kind of generally accepted as the best practices today is ongoing support services for somebody.
And Dr. Jennifer Potter, what do you see as an ongoing way to try and help people? Obviously, you think that the medical pharmaceutical approach is a way to help people get off of these drugs. A doctor supervision is necessary. Sending people off to a spa or whatever. I mean, it's time. I've seen that. You know, because there are people who are getting addicted to painkillers. They're upper-level income households. They don't want to go to recovery because they're afraid of the stigma. So instead, they go off to some place for a couple of weeks thinking that that's going to help them. Then they come back home to the same stressors that they were experiencing before, and they fall off, and then they experience the overdose.
Yeah, and just to be clear on medication, today, the best evidence-based treatment that we have is medication. I don't want anyone to have to take any medicine. I want people to have a safe life. And to do that, they need the recovery coaching that Josh was just talking about. They need the family and prevention support that Abigail was just talking about. And they need to get high quality care. And so that's why I think medication is so important. It's why we also need research to come up with better treatments.
More research. That's part of the plan and part of the government's funding, but also we have funding for street outreach as well. And this is, we're going to continue. The number to call in, if you've got a question or a comment about the opioid crisis, 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're talking about opioids and our community. We invite you to call in 210-614-8980. One of our guests today is Josh Green. He's a Youth Recovery Community Center Coordinator, Peer Recovery Leader at Rise Recovery. And Josh, you got me curious about your story. You told us earlier that you've been there. Talk about your journey here.
Yeah, my experience in addiction and recovery is no different than, you know, the thousands of Americans that are affected by substance use disorder, specifically opioid use disorder. You know, it started for me just like it does with many people, being in high school, experimenting with drugs, coming across prescription painkillers, and really it getting out of hand, escalating really quickly and getting out of control from there. I had all the family support necessary to get sober. It just wasn't enough to help with what I needed. I did not have access in our community to resources specifically for a young person to get sober and to get into recovery. But I was lucky enough, which many aren't. That's where my story kind of changes and gets different, is that I had the good fortune to get a spot in one of the only public-funded treatment centers in San Antonio. And from there, I was provided with all the resources necessary to overcome addiction and to live a sustained life in recovery.
So were you like injured? How did you first started getting into, so was this a party drug?
High school experimentation with drugs, just here, recreational use, prescription painkillers.
Here in San Antonio?
Absolutely, yes.
Do you think that a lot of kids are kind of fall into that?
You know, from my work professionally and my personal experience, I'll say that I was only out of high school for a few months when the first member of my graduating class died from an opioid overdose, and several have followed since then. I'm working with more and more people on a day-to-day basis, and more calls from distressed family members about their adolescent child, you know, struggling with an opioid addiction.
So, what would parents need to know about keeping an eye out and how to intervene early?
A lot of the things that we've talked about today, of course, you know, limiting access if you have opioids in your household is a good place to start. Being aware of the various types of treatment for addiction, what the best practices are and what the evidence-based research says, what would give your child the best shot at a successful treatment episode if they were to become addicted. Being aware of all of those things is, you know, likely to give them a better shot at successful recovery for them and the family.
Let's go back to the phone lines. And I want to thank you very much, Josh, for telling that story. Johnny is called in. Johnny, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, David. Thank you for having me. I was actually the gentleman that you ran into on the bus.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to thank you for sharing the story. It's really important. What I had as a question is the addiction, is it a disease in the true sense of the word? Is it a mental disease that that needs to be treated? Is it something that you can't help, or is it just, you know, your environment and other things of that nature? Is it inherent in the person, or is it just, you know, a coincidence, if you want to call it that?
Johnny, thank you for the call. That's a complicated question. Let me go first over to Abigail Moore with the San Antonio Council on Drug and Alcohol Abuse. You see it as a disease.
Yes, it is a disease.
But is it a disease that's aggravated by the environment, aggravated by all sorts of things?
A combination of all. Their environment, genetics, what they're exposed to early in life, their coping skills, sometimes mental health, other diseases. But it is a disease. It's medically treated. It's covered by your insurance. We need to remove the stigma. It is a disease. And sometimes it is genetically predisposition. Sometimes it's environmental. Sometimes it's combination of all. So yes, do people begin to experiment, whether they're young or adolescent or young adults, and do they choose to use? But once the disease, and they don't know that if they're already genetically predisposed at a higher level, and nobody walks around with an A on their forehead for addiction. And so we don't know who those individuals are. And so providing education, providing treatment, removing stigma, all those things are important.
So a person who finds themselves addicted, they are not a less than type of individual.
Absolutely.
They do not have a moral failure. They are just got caught up in a maelstrom in our society, something that a lot of people have made a lot of money off of from. They've pushed us into our society, and so we've got to figure out how to help those people. Dr. Jennifer?
One of the things that I heard in the question was this struggle that we have in our culture between a disease and personal responsibility. Nowhere do I see as much blame as goes on when people are struggling with addiction. But people still are responsible for their own behaviors. I think what we're talking about here in the room today is that having a disease doesn't give you the right to steal. It doesn't give you the right to do illegal things. It doesn't give you a right to walk away from taking personal responsibility. A lot of diseases have have behavioral roles, just like obesity has a personal role. So the problem is if we only blame ourselves and put it as a personal responsibility, or dare I say it, a moral failing, that there is something corrupted about you, that's a barrier to your recovery. It's a barrier to getting treatment, and it's a barrier to getting back to a productive life. And so if people can lift that burden off, the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse said, in all my years as an addiction professional, I have never seen someone who wanted to become an addict. And I think it's an important lesson for all of us to give ourselves permission to focus on treatment and prevention and not on blaming.
So, Josh Green, since you're a youth recovery a person, you're dealing with this. Do you see that a lot where people are kind of like doing this self-examination? How did I end up here? What did I do wrong? What's wrong with me? Why did I? And do we have to absolve people of that self-defeating guilt and help to get to find recovery?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what I like to do is just point it out as a statistical likelihood that you or somebody you know is going to be affected by addiction directly, or you're going to be somebody who's struggling with substance use disorder. Like's kind of been touched on already, addiction comes with so many behavioral traits that are undesirable. You know, an addict doesn't just look like a sick person. They look like a criminal, willfully ignorant, arrogant, irrational, emotional person, because those are just some of the symptoms of addiction that come with it. So it's really hard, you know, that fight to look at somebody like a sick person and that they need help, or if they are bad.
Right. So another caller. We got a lot of calls still. I'm trying to get them in. Steven, welcome to The Source. Steven, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me. You know, I think for me, I just kind of wanted to call and just maybe give some people a little bit of hope. You know, I'm 7.5 years clean and sober from opiates. And I think Suboxone is one of those things that's relatively new. And I think even for someone like me who got sober using it as a detox protocol to come off of opiates and then incorporating the 12 steps, I mean, that's, I still think, in my personal opinion, that's the way for long-term sobriety for me, and to not have to deal with taking Suboxone every day or methadone every day. But I know it's not for everyone. So from like a harm reduction standpoint, I think it's necessary, but I don't think that it should be discounted, the 12 steps being incorporated into recovery.
Okay, Stephen, thank you for the call. And did you want to react to that, Abigail?
That's part of recovery. And so there's many pathways.
I want to focus on the hope aspect.
Yes, the hope aspect. We want to give people hope. The family members, the parents, the children that are seeing their adult parents struggling. There is hope. There is recovery for the family and for the individuals struggling with the disease. So please reach out. There are many pathways. AA 12-step community is a great way to find recovery. And so let's get the hope out there.
And so the task force.
Yes, the task force. We're actively meeting on a monthly basis. The Joint Opioid Task Force is working on public education. And so we're doing a lot of videos, kits that help school districts provide education to the schools and churches. We're also working with a treatment subcommittee, improving treatment resources out there, whether it's medically assisted treatment, faith-based, 12-step, but again, best practices, looking at best practices and enhancing access to treatment out there, and then providing education to the providers, whether they're physicians and or therapists, being able to give them the tools that we all need to work together.
And so Dr. Jennifer Potter, when we first started talking about this a few years ago here on the air, we were talking about naloxone as a way to help people. That was still kind of out on the fringe of San Antonio, but now it's pretty much available and people are using it to save lives.
So EMS in the city of San Antonio has carried naloxone for a long time, and they will tell you that. What's changing is that there's a large push to make sure that we have a lot of access to naloxone. You've got to work quickly, and you have to be able to spot an overdose when it's occurring and know what to do. So getting naloxone, which is a relatively benign medicine, to the community is very important, and that's what we're working on.
The symposium that's going to be happening tomorrow, is it tomorrow?
It's Friday and Saturday. On the Friday, we have a community and clinical education event. It's hashtag SASUS18. It's the San Antonio Substance Use Symposium, and we're focusing this year on opioids. And it's an opportunity for community members to share with the community and leadership and the Opioid Task Force their thoughts and opinions, as well as get some really great education. And that it is at UT Health San Antonio.
And it's free and open to the public. I want to thank all of our guests, Dr. Jennifer Potter, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Associate Dean of Research at the School of Medicine at UT Health San Antonio. Josh Green is with us. He's the Youth Recovery Community Center Coordinator and Peer Recovery Leader at Rise Recovery. And Abigail Moore, CEO of the San Antonio Council on Drug and Alcohol Abuse. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.